7. Matthew chapter 27. How do you preach a sermon on the crucifixion? Of course, that was my job. I probably should have that figured out and not ask you all. But, I mean, this is, Paul says in 1 Corinthians, this is what I'm preaching in everything that I say. He says that he preaches Christ and him crucified. That encapsulates everything he preaches. Sometimes in Bible studies, like in the community or with a new Christian or someone new to the Bible, I'll study the book of Mark, and what I've found is a lot of times when I've gotten there, we just read it, and we don't get into the weeds a lot, we don't have a lot of discussion, because so many of the pieces have already been there, laid. So many of the building blocks have been laid for appreciating it. I do want us to dwell on some things. We're going to be starting in verses 27, and we're going to break it into three parts and read through verse 50 by the end of this lesson. But I want us to dwell on it and to just renew our appreciation of what we're reading. Obviously, we make an effort to do that every week, at least. But when Matthew wrote to these Christians, wrote this book for Christians that we're reading today, they already knew the story. They were Christians. The people, by the time this was being written, knew this story well. And for them, they were already remembering it every week as well. And so they would need, even as they read this, to renew their awe for what they believed and what defines them as Christians. So I encourage you to do that. So much of what happened was not new for Matthew's original readers, isn't new for us, but it was like nothing anyone would have imagined when they were living through it. The people who lived it, it just broke everyone's expectations. It was something they couldn't understand as it happened. And so put yourself there. And the Gospels give us so much to help us to do that, to know it in a lot of detail, to appreciate it. So let's do that again and be captivated by the same Gospel story that have been captivating Christians for 2,000 years. Let's go ahead and read verses 27 through 31 for now. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him, and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. I'm going to break this sermon up into three basic points from each of these that are, again, kind of stating the obvious, again, for Christians, but what wasn't obvious to them at the time and are at the core of what makes the gospel so powerful. D.A. Carson has an influence on some of this, the way that I've thought about these points. I'll just put that out there. If you want to find his sermon, The Four Ironies of the Cross, I've got three, but he had four. I'd recommend that if you want to look that up, The Four Ironies of the Cross by D.A. Carson. Not the same sermon, but he's influenced this these major points. The one they mocked as a fraud is actually the true king. And that's pretty easy for us. Like we've been working on that throughout the whole book of Matthew. Jesus is the King of Kings. We're followers of the King of Kings. We've been going through that for the year, and we understand that he's a different kind of king. But in this moment, they are mocking him as a king, and he is, in fact, the king. And they must have thought they were so clever in this moment. Once you put yourself there, it's convenient to put yourself there and think of yourself as Jesus. And it's good to think of what he went through. Or to just see it as an audience of hearing the story, but put yourself there as being one of the soldiers. Maybe that's the more appropriate place for us to put ourselves. They put some effort into this. Somebody had to go and volunteer, apparently, one of their robes. There's not, maybe some question, it doesn't describe exactly what where this robe came from, but if you're looking for a red or purple robe, the vocabulary is flexible in ancient colors. Pink, red, purple, kind of all the same family of colors. Looking for a purple robe? You didn't have to look far if you're with a group of Roman soldiers. They largely wore these, you can picture maybe from movies or something, these kind of reddish, faded, purplish robes. Apparently someone volunteered their own robe as this joke. Sure, maybe you got a slap on the back for that clever idea. Oh, he's a king! Let's give him the royal colors and the prestigious colors of Rome. Someone went to the trouble of taking branches from some kind of thorny shrub and cutting that off and twisting that to be this humiliating, makeshift, pain-inducing crown. I mean, they actually did that. They didn't just joke about it. Someone went and did that. Someone went, apparently, and cut down a reed and to be a makeshift scepter. And they mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews. They spat on him and beat him. We human beings can find so much satisfaction in putting others beneath us. And if the person we're putting beneath us thinks a lot of themselves, claims something great about themselves, it's all the more satisfying to put them beneath us. I'm reading through a book, Unbroken, that makes me think about what POWs went through. There's things I've never thought about before reading this book, about some of the torture that happened for those who are POWs under the Japanese in World War II. Thinking about human suffering in a new context, and then coming to preparing a lesson like this, just helped me appreciate things that maybe I've become numb to about the fact that our Lord was tortured. The torture, like that of World War II and some of the atrocities there, Jesus endured that kind of humiliation and dehumanizing and unimaginable torture. God in the flesh going through that for us. But reading that book also makes me think about the psychology of the people inducing that. The people who inflict such torture. The author of that book makes you think about how is it someone ends up being a prisoner of war guard? How do you get that assignment? And suggests, at least by implication, that it's probably not by having the most seniority, probably not by having the most prestige, but even having that assignment was probably a mark of humiliation. Certainly for some, it was. You didn't reach your career hopes in the military if you were a prisoner of war, and perhaps they coped by heaping their own humiliation onto their prisoners of war. Think about how you end up being a soldier who runs crucifixions. I'm not saying that the Romans were ashamed of crucifixion altogether, but I just doubt it that it was anyone's dream career to be stationed in Jerusalem during the times of the festivals and to be in charge of a crucifixion. How'd they get there? And how humiliated might they be in that role? And how did it feel for them? What did they get out of it? When they took one of the subject nation's people, this Jew, who thought he was some great king of the Jews, and got to show him that he was nothing. Maybe for a little bit, they relieved some of their own shame and felt so powerful over one who appeared so powerless. seeing Jesus be mocked and beaten in such specific ways. The Gospels didn't have to do that. They could have said he was crucified and that's it. And then with history, the distance from crucifixions, we don't have to think about what all that entailed. But the Gospels give us details. Our hymns, our beautiful hymns, run us through the torture that Jesus experienced and they put us there as the cause of that suffering. And so I asked Oren if he'd lead How Deep the Father's Love afterward. The second verse, "Behold the man upon a cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished." Envision our voice mocking him. I think that's one thing we're supposed to do when we read these, is to recognize our part in his suffering. We don't get to, like Pilate, according to John's Gospel, we don't get to wash our hands of the situation. We did this. And when we've been full of pride, it's at the Lord's expense. When we put another person down, made in the image of God, we are as guilty as the ones who put that crown of thorns on his head. Jesus, of course, as we've been seeing in Matthew, has been reversing our understanding of power. He is a king like no other. As they're mocking him, surely they've thought about what in the world this guy's doing, calling himself a king. Because you can call yourself whatever you want, but that title is apparently meaningless if you have no actual power. Of course, Jesus did have all power, but it was so inconceivable for them that someone with any power would have allowed any of this to be done to him. But guys, I think this is true for us today, for our world, you know, in basically any culture. Power is for self-service, self-advancement, when you get down to it. And for someone to allow this to happen to themselves is just unimaginable. I cannot remember where I was reading this or why, but I was reading one time about someone's recommendations about how to teach people from a Hindu background. I know that's more of a generic term for just a whole plethora of religious beliefs, but how to teach people from that background in India. And they were saying to be careful, you know, when you're talking about miracles in the Bible, because if you show them, you know, Samson carrying these gates up this hill, they got legends of people doing greater things than that. So, you know, make sure you show them, you know, more powerful miracles. I mean, you could maybe show that Jesus is the Word who was there at the beginning and through whom all things were created, and that probably ought to do pretty good. But the Gospel entails the God who, in his position of power, gave himself up. And it's not going to be that we're going to woo people who value power by just looking at it and saying, well, the God of the Bible and Jesus and all his miracles is more powerful than your gods. That is part of it. That is a step. But Paul preached Christ him crucified. The Gospels drive us to that event. And that's going to make the impact. Not by saying, okay, here's your system of beliefs about who's powerful. I mean, they have the whole caste system that's influenced their history in India. Their picture of power and their system of how that works, and all you come in and say is, well, Jesus is more powerful than all of those guys. But what if you come in and say, Jesus undermines that whole system of power, that whole hierarchy, and being the greatest and yet giving himself up. And it's useful to use something like India and Hindu religions, but does not apply for us in our culture or any culture, in practically how we actually use power. It bewilders people. Again, people are used to the gospel story, and they forget, but if people dwell on it, this contradicts the way they think and live. And when we then go out and we live in ways that sacrifice like Christ, it will bewilder them as well. People will be surprised, shocked, when we follow Christ to the cross. Of course, Jesus has been teaching that all along. Matthew 20, you can turn over there if you like. This one never gets old for me. Matthew 20, verses 25 through 28. Before he got to the cross, he interpreted its meaning to his disciples. Not that they were understanding it at the time. Matthew 20, verse 25. Sorry, I'm going to find it. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the nations lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." It was meant to turn it all upside down. And it ought to be refreshing that Jesus doesn't just talk about servant leadership, but he does it here. It can be discouraging when people do talk about that kind of thing, talk about the cross in Christian terms, talk about self-sacrifice and denying yourself. And then those people get to a point where they say, "Yeah, I can't make that sacrifice because I need to have an influence. I can't give this up. I can't give this position up because of the good I need to do." I've mentioned this Mars Hill podcast I've been listening to, and one of the guys who was involved with this megachurch had a problem of abusing authority. He realized that he himself had said some things that under the influence of other leaders that contradicted what he would have preached. He preached Christ and him crucified, but then he realized that he had this nagging memory of talking to someone, trying to organize a meeting with other church leaders, and them saying, "Well, that time doesn't work for everyone else." And he told them, "If it doesn't work for me, it doesn't work for the church." Small thing, but I think it's probably right that nagged him, and that he recognized a contradiction from what he had believed and said, or from what he had taught, at least, what he thought he believed. It's tempting when you see those kinds of things, scandals among religious people and figures, maybe people from books you've read and things you've watched that you appreciated, when it turns out that's all a lie for them personally. And it could be tempting to give up on Jesus because of these hypocrites. But you didn't start following Jesus because of them. Not just because of them. Maybe they were an instrument. But the whole point of being a disciple is that you're a disciple of Jesus. And he is the real thing. There's not going to be some scandal discovered. And you know, because he went through the cross. Others, when they met their cross, didn't. Jesus went through, and we know. The fullest extreme of what he taught, he went through. He didn't talk big and then, you know, just follow a more muted version of that. He went all the way, even if some of people who preach Christ don't. So, Jesus, in as he's going to be crucified, is continuing to undermine the expectations of authority. The one who they mocked as a fraud was actually the king. Let's go over back to Matthew 27, read verses 32 through 44. I want to think about how they taunted, the one they taunted as he was suffering for them. As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. Sorry, I read that twice. No, I didn't. They offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, but when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. The sign they put above his cross lists no crimes. They have nothing against Jesus. Not legally, not morally, nothing against his character. He's spotless. Of course, they put that he's blasphemed or is a competing claim to be king. Jesus came in word and deed. And his words were ideal, and his deeds matched his words. I haven't dwelt a lot on this as I've preached through this, but Matthew's entire gospel is arranged with those categories: Jesus' words and deeds, story form, and then speeches. He does that five times, five pairs of Jesus' stories about Jesus and then his speeches. That's what he's doing. He's doing and he's teaching. And his doing is completely upright. And when they get to the cross, they should see his sacrifice as epitomizing all he's taught. I found it helpful to reflect on the Sermon on the Mount. We're far enough out of there. I guess we can just read, go through the whole from that class. But reflecting on the Sermon on the Mount in light of the cross, which, you know, we should do anyway. But I invite you to do this more sometime. But I just want to highlight a couple things. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely. He wasn't just talking. It wasn't hyperbole. At the cross, we learn that the one who said that if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him also the other. But he meant it. The one who allows soldiers to take his clothing and divide it, gamble over for it. He meant it when he said, "If anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well." The one who allowed them to force him, so far as he was physically able, to carry his cross. He meant it when he said, "If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles." It wasn't just talking. It wasn't just idealistic stuff, naive stuff, that only is applied under the easiest, perfect conditions, but in the most difficult. He was really good. all the way through, all the way through his suffering and death. So, even in his suffering, his righteousness exceeds those who were bringing about his crucifixion, as he also talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. So I invite you to do that some more another time. Just walk through the Sermon on the Mount and thinking about the cross. They say to him, he saved others, he cannot save himself. They challenge him to get down from the cross. Of course, not actually thinking that he would. Of course, they've got it all backwards. What they say there gets you to think about the deeper truth that's going on. It's a twisted version of that. He saved others, he cannot save himself. We all know what's actually going on. This is irony, all of this. He had rescued others. What did he have rescued others from? He had rescued others from disease, from demon possession. But his greatest rescue was happening right before their eyes, as they spoke. Even as Jesus healed people, back in Matthew 8, Matthew says, and this is just like Isaiah talked about, that he bore our illnesses and our diseases. Quoting from Isaiah 53, maybe adjusting it a little bit. Because Matthew knew that in Jesus' miracles, when he was rescuing people from these ailments, that there was a greater, deeper rescue that was at the heart of everything Jesus was going to accomplish. And so Isaiah 53, verse 4 says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed." He was rescuing them in that very moment. And the only accusation they had against him was that he claimed to be this king. And he was. And he was suffering innocently and as a ransom in the place of many. But if he answered their challenge, "Come on down from that cross," if he answered that challenge, he would not have saved others. It was by staying on the cross that he'd rescue us from our sin. So, the one they mocked, the one they ridiculed as he suffered, was actually suffering for them and for us. Finally, then, the last section there that I want to cover today is verses 45 through 50. And just to say, before we read, Jesus, who cried out in despair, actually trusted in God. That's the great truth for us. Verse 45. "Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, 'This man is calling Elijah.' And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the other says, 'Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him.' And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." Matthew records something that others don't, that also shows the power of what happened beyond just the darkness, but the veil being torn and the earthquake and the tombs being opened and saints' bodies walking around alive because of the true power that was there. He cried out. By the time you read Jesus' cry here, Matthew has already been priming us for recognition of Psalm 22 in the background here. Pretty strongly, actually. And so you read the soldiers dividing Jesus' garments. You remember Psalm 22, verse 18, "They divided my garments among them, for my clothing they cast lots." Read of Matthew choosing to describe it as wagging their heads. I suppose you can describe whatever taunt and whatever physical motion they're doing in different ways, but he uses verbatim the words from his Greek Old Testament, from Psalm 22, verse 39. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. It's also in a couple of other psalms where someone innocently suffering is being taunted like that. Psalm 22, verse 7, 8. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. This one is the one that is really strange. It's precisely what Matthew says these people said. I mean, word for word, they said the words of Psalm 22, verses 7 through 8, that David said people were saying about him as he suffered. Was Matthew kind of repurposing their words and fitting it into Psalm 22 in some creative way? Maybe that's what they said exactly. And if they said it exactly, I suppose it's possible they did that accidentally. Like Caiaphas prophesying and not realizing he's prophesying. Maybe something happened and God was just acting there in some way to orchestrate their words. But maybe they did it completely on purpose. How would they do that? Obviously they're not saying, we think he's the Messiah, and then we're fulfilling that prophecy by saying the words of Psalm 22. No. But maybe they knew that for David, those people were wrong. And this guy claims to be the son of David. And if he is, didn't God rescue David? So where's your God now? If God is pleased with you, he rescued David, what's he going to do with you? I don't know. But I wonder if they did intentionally use Psalm 22 to taunt him in that way. Again, to make themselves feel better. When Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? It does show a sense of despair. We know what he's going through here. Theoretically, we know what he's going through here. And I know this kind of discussion is nothing new to most of you, but it's still powerful for us to dwell on. David had been forsaken. I guess I haven't stated it outright. This is from Psalm 22, verse 1. Kicking off this whole psalm where David is crying out to God to rescue him from this suffering and persecution. David had been, in a very specific sense, forsaken. Not absolutely, not ultimately, not permanently, but still meaningfully. And I think if you look, I can share some notes another time, but the language of covenant in the Psalms and other places, that this idea of forsaking in a covenant context is just to say he's going through the things that don't belong to a man of faith. He's going through some of the suffering and curses of the covenant, that in that sense, God has forsaken him for a time in a limited way. And Jesus, in that same very specific sense, was forsaken. So far as God allowed this righteous one, his innocent son, to suffer for our sin for a time, he was withholding the blessings that he deserved. He was allowing him to take on the curse that belongs only on the guilty. So in covenant terms, in a limited sense, he was forsaken. But you know, when you read the whole of Psalm 22, that it's not just about a guy who's crying out in despair because of the hard thing that's happening to him, but he's crying out to God because he knows God is the one that can rescue him, that cares for him. And he turns around halfway through that psalm with words of praise because God has rescued him. And so it is, in some sense, despair for the sense in which God has forsaken him, and yet he knows that God has not permanently or absolutely or ultimately forsaken him. He does trust. Jesus, is mocked as a fraud, but he's actually the King of Kings. He suffers, and they mock him in his suffering, and yet he is suffering for us all. And Jesus cries out as one in despair, but he actually is one in those very words who is relying on and trusting in his God. These are things we think about all the time, but we will never be done thinking about them and dwelling on them. By faith, this week, tomorrow, and through our lives, bewilder the people around you as they see the irony of the cross in you. Let them be taken aback when they see that you don't just talk like some other Christians they know talk, but that you actually follow the King of Kings all the way to the cross. We're going to stand and sing.